Welcome to the Critical Few Actions to Improve Your Business podcast. I'm John Downes, and I'm here to help you cut through the overwhelm and prioritize what matters most to improve your business. Let's get started and discover the critical few actions that have the biggest impact. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Elise Margo, who I believe is one of Australia's leading coaches in negotiation. Heck, she's a lawyer and listed 3 years running on Doyle's list of leading Victorian mediators. She's been named in The Age Melbourne magazine as one of the top 100 most passionate, powerful, and provocative personalities. So I think you'll agree, we're in for a treat. Elise, welcome.
Thank you for having me on your podcast, John. I look forward to provoking everybody today on the topic of negotiation. And it's wonderful to be able to speak to you about a topic that I'm passionate about as well.
Fantastic. So today we're going to talk about how you help business leaders master the art of negotiation. I feel that this is an essential skill for all medium-sized business leaders across all industries, and I look forward to upping my game as part of this. So to get us started, Elise, tell us a bit about your journey into the art of negotiation.
Well, I started very young, John. I was the youngest and only girl and had two older brothers. And as I wasn't as strong as them to fight my way through and get my way, I had to learn to negotiate using verbal cues as opposed to fists. So I started pretty early on that journey. But as a lawyer and as a litigator to begin with, I had to learn to negotiate with often aggressive parties to try and get the best outcome for my clients in resolving disputes, because it is one of the worst risks for a business to get involved in lengthy litigation. It is costly, it takes time, and it burns bridges. So I've always had that philosophy. How do I help my clients resolve a burning dispute in a way that is practical and commercial? And this was the basis on which I started building my negotiation abilities and honing those abilities. But then I was given an opportunity to work for Telstra Wholesale in helping them bring a new wholesale agreement when they started their wholesale division, which they wanted to use across the board for the small ISPs who were entering into the market, but as well as Vodafone and Optus, who were also part of that agreement. So I went from trying to resolve disputes in a negotiating setting to actually trying to negotiate massive transactions and smaller transactions using a contractual base. And so I moved from dispute to transaction, and I've been doing that ever since as general counsel for a finance company and then starting my own medium general counsel business for medium entrepreneur and small businesses, as well as in the mediation space where mediators are actually expert negotiators who help you resolve disputes.
Well, that's interesting because it's absolutely probably the epitome of negotiation skills to actually help those who are emotional challenged and at risk to actually help them actually negotiate their way into a resolution as opposed to turning it into fisticuffs at 10 paces.
Exactly.
I guess in mid-market businesses, leaders often leave millions on the table simply because they don't have that ability to negotiate effectively. So today we're going to change that. Let's break down the art of negotiation into the critical few actions that we can apply immediately. So Elise, to start us off, what do you see as the top five key principles and skills that a business leader needs to be able to master to be successful?
Well, the first is, and it's often overlooked, and I'd say it's almost one and two of the five critical skills, is preparation for negotiation. And many people say, well, of course we prepare, we got our, you know, let's take the transaction. We've looked at our products that we want to sell, we've looked at the market, we've got our price, but they haven't really dug deep into the preparation. It's just, it's very superficial. And so you can't begin to negotiate your best outcome if you haven't prepared Almost, as I say, it's almost like going into court and having to persuade the judge, but the judge is the person on the other side of the negotiating table, and they're the only ones who can give you what you want at that stage, certainly in a transaction. And so it's digging deep into that preparation, and it's often what entrepreneurs and small business owners would say is boring work. Medium-sized businesses might not think of it as so boring, but it is hard work, and it can be boring, and it can be tiresome, and it does take time. But that, to me, is the most important and crucial skill, because so much is left off the table and not even part of the negotiation. And so much is not obtained, or you're unsuccessful necessarily, or as successful as you could be, because you haven't done the hard yards of preparation. So I am one of the biggest, I always say you need to prepare to persuade, and without the preparation, you don't have a hope. This, well, you might be lucky. I shouldn't say there's always an exception. But that prepare to persuade. The next part of it is to look long term. So strategically, to plan long term in a business situation, you have to not just look at the situation you're in, whether it's a dispute or it's a transaction, and say, well, I want this in the next month or 2 months or 3 months. It's what will it look like for me, not just this year or in the next few months, but in a year's time, 3 years, 5 years' time, even 10 years' time. What is my long-term strategic goal? Because if I can't see where I'm heading long-term, short-term gains in a negotiation might not actually assist me in getting where I need to be. Or I might be asking for different things. So instead of asking for a higher price if I'm selling something, I might be able to give that for a longer-term relationship. And so it's that long-term vision, preparation, long-term vision. Knowing very clearly that I have thought through and spoken, so the third part, spoken to other people who might be affected in my business or in my relationships by this negotiation. So very few of us are an island. I mean, that sounds cliched, no person is an island, but so whatever I negotiate might have impact on my business team, my shareholders, and my family. So it might be 2 second thought, but it should be there. What is the long-term impact of the people, and what can they give to me in preparing for the negotiation? Because sometimes they might have ideas that I haven't thought through. So bring your team along, but know what you're looking for, and don't let your team dictate necessarily, but bring them through for an ear. And then the fourth part of it is, how do I persuade the other side? Because I keep saying the other side is your judge. They are the ones who are going to decide whether to give you what you want. And how do I ask them? Yes, many times I think I can demand, and the bigger the organization, the more they think they can demand of the other side to give them what they want. But most of the time, I need to persuade the other person it's in their best interest to give me what I want. So it's how do I persuade them? And that means thinking about the other party, who they are. What would be their interests be, and how do we deal with that? And finally, it's how do I tailor everything and not lose my way in the negotiation and end up going down blind holes? Because in the cut and thrust of a negotiation, sometimes there's a gleaming little penny lying on the ground, and I'm so busy going down that pole, I lose sight of everything else, and what I end up with is a little bit of a mishmash of stuff, and it's not very clearly honed in the final outcome. So it's not losing your way, and making sure that the final outcome is well documented, it is succinct, and it deals with what you're looking for.
So prepare to persuade, look long term, think about how to actually persuade your judge or your future partner as opposed to opponent, and how do we tailor ourselves so that we navigate the journey and don't get lost. So let's go through them one at a time. Perhaps you can take me through a case example that'll actually bring this to life for me.
So I'm going to take something. The case that I'm going to refer to is one where I was assisting a business owner who wanted to sell their business. And there were a number of parties who were interested in the business, right? So
Oh,
there
that's
was
good because I've got one of
excitement.
those going on at the moment. So this is going to be really topical.
So, my client was thinking, well, This is great. I've got a few opportunities. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to rock and roll. And we're going to just meet all, I'm going to meet all the parties. I'm going to meet each interested party. I'm going to talk to them. And this is going to be brilliant. And then I'll see what they say. And I've got a number in mind, and let's just go for it. And I said, well, I'm going to be the person who's flying the kite, and I'm reeling you in for a little chat about preparation. So that was prepare to persuade. And so even if we've got three people interested, before you even speak to them, let's just look at your business and let's see how do we maximize what you're looking for and what are you actually looking for. Yes, there's an amount of money on the table that you're thinking of. Could you be asking for more? Is it realistic? Should you be prepared to accept less? And also, are there other parts of the sale that is important to you? For example, are you wanting to hold on to certain assets of the business that you want to keep using going forward? Where do you see yourself moving from the sale? So is there something here that you're going to need out of this to carry on with your life afterwards? Is it a dollar figure? Is it having an asset to start elsewhere doing something different? What are those drivers? And let's look at that. And then the next part of it is the people in the business, because this wasn't, a one-person business. There was staff. It was working well. There were relationships with suppliers. And so what does that mean to you? Do you want to keep up the relationships with the suppliers? Do you have a good relationship with the staff? Do you want to, have they worked for you for years? Do you want to assist them? It doesn't matter. Is the dollar figure the everything? And so we had a really good discussion in the preparation. I also suggested speaking to tax advisors, financial advisors, business advisors like yourself, Joe, strategic advisors, about how to best structure whatever was coming out of this from a dollar perspective, from a strategic perspective, because I'm not the expert on business strategy or finance or tax, but these are things you should be thinking of before you even step into speaking to a prospective buyer. And so, based on that preparation, which took about 3, 4 weeks, my client then came up with the idea that the dollar figure was important and worked out how it could be structured and also whether it was worth selling the shares of the company because the business was structured in a company or whether it was worth selling the assets
Assets, yes.
and what assets to sell, were all the assets. And there was one asset that he wanted to keep and it wasn't really important to the deal. But he wanted to keep the asset and it was an IP asset. It was a brand asset. Not hugely impactful to the business, but it was important to my client. So we talked about that and we set out with the help of the financial advisor and business strategist, the wants of the client and what was walk away one. So like if I don't get this, it's not worth my while, to what do I give up? And I'd never say that we need to compromise. We don't compromise. We just give up some things to get what we want. Don't, because compromise is a negative word, but what are there giveaways? Are there things I can give away to get what I want? What are those and how do we do it? And then we started looking at each party who was interested in buying the business. Who were they? So for example, if I'm making these figures up, $10 million for my business, it's no use speaking to someone who can only afford to pay me $5 million, right? I've got to find someone who has the means to buy the business at the amount. Obviously, it's got to be reasonable. It's got to be well thought through. People aren't going to pay $10 million for a $2 million company. But if it's worth $10 million, no use speaking to people who can't afford it. The second thing, if a culture of my business and brand of the business is important to me, what I've built up, then I don't necessarily want a venture capitalist coming in and working with someone. Might want that, but that those kind of thought process of venture capitalists funding businesses, they can be problematic. Venture capitalists are not necessarily interested in the brand. So maybe there's someone there who I see has a very close cultural fit to me. They can afford the business, and I think it would be in safe hands. I can't promise that, but if that person's available and they can give me the amount of money I want and they can take my brand where I think it's going, that's not a bad idea. And so my client thought of all these things. And the reason I'm mentioning all three is because the one person was definitely a waste of time speaking to. They didn't have the funds to pay. So why waste your time in that negotiation? And then there was the thought, well, The one purchaser was going to be funded by venture capitalists, and the other one was wealthy enough and had the funds to pay for the business or get the loans for it. But there was a closer cultural fit. And at that point, that isn't the time to stop talking to the venture capitalist-backed business. It's just,
No.
well, theoretically, that might be my favorite person. I still need to speak. I still need to speak to them. So that was the next preparation. Let's do the research on them. Let's find out more about it. And how do I go in? And what do I work hard on? And so at the end of the day, venture capitalists didn't give a lot more money. Yes, I keep calling them venture capitalists, wasn't it? It was a company that was backed by the venture capitalists. That they weren't going to give a lot more money in the purchase price. So if they had offered their team, we said, well, to give up that cultural fit, we want an extra $2, 3, $4 million at least on the table, because that's a dollar value to give away the culture they get. But they weren't going much higher. It was, I think, approximately $750,000, which is a lot of money generally. But the person that I was representing, the importance was that brand continuing. He wanted the staff to be still working in the business. He wanted continuity of brand and thought and growth of the business carrying on to legacy. And he thought that that was worth giving. Now, that's a lot to think about, right? $750,000 is a lot of money. But for him, the continuation of brand and taking his business where he thought his legacy could continue was more important to him. And he was getting enough money to fulfill his needs.
So that certainly also picks up on that view, taking the long-term view. Where do we want to be in 5, 10 years' time?
So I'm pleased to say we had a successful negotiation with both parties, and then went for the other. And of course, it was kept encapsulated in a good sale of business agreement at the end of it.
Of course.
And I for 6 months down the line, I really don't know if the legacy has been carried on, but the client was happy.
Well, that's really important. There are so many factors, just coming back to that preparation, that there are so many factors in the sale, for example, of a business. But for many transactions, are there small business tax relief on capital gains tax and those sorts of things? What's going to happen with the property, and do I want the property as part of my superannuation asset? Or do I actually want a clean break from something that I've been working on for 30 years? It's been dealing with that exact issue with the client and understanding, one of the key things for that client was actually the cultural fit. And will these be good buyers for my staff, which is effectively my family of 35 people? Am I handing over the reins to look after this family of 35 people to an appropriate person, and will they be treated well? And in fact, actually, that was a couple of million dollars of in value in the equation for that person, because he'd been working with some of these people for 25 years, and he was more concerned about that than he was concerned about the value at the end of the day. I mean, whether it's 20 or $21 million doesn't make a lot of difference, So, but also, if they hadn't prepared for that process and hadn't started thinking that through in the heat of negotiation with two or three interested parties, there's opportunity for things to be missed and therefore for longer term regret. So I can see that these skills are going to be essential every day. One of the things that I'm seeing that's causing lots of internal conflict is dealing with family businesses and how to manage intergenerational wealth transfer. This has got to be an area which is really fraught with unresolved issues, but also unresolved emotions that have potentially been buried for years.
Yes, and this is an area that I have worked in, both in mediation skills, funnily enough,
Yes.
and as a legal advisor. It's such an interesting phenomenon, because we always say, don't go into business with family or friends. That's the first part, and
Well, it's so
if
emotionally, it's so often emotionally charged.
do, exactly. It's but then you look at very successful family businesses or businesses started with friends. So that's the first step, is don't do it. But if you're in it,
like that. It's a good negotiation practice. Are you family? Well, then
No, we're not even going there. It's really from the beginning to know what you're looking for. So the first part is for those who are thinking of going into family business
no.
that we can talk about. And then I'll go into people already in the thrust of it and starting to think of succession planning or an intergenerational wealth transfer. But the first part is whether you're going into business with family or friends, you have to factor in that emotional drive and the fact that this can ruin entire family relationships and friendships. So right from the beginning in the negotiation, besides how we're going to work together, is what do we do if there's strife and how do we resolve it? And think of that's the preparation stage in that part. So we'll get into that in a greater detail, but it's worthwhile just thinking if you start at the beginning, thinking about the issues that you will face in those businesses, and obviously things change over time, but knowing we at some stage we're going to have to talk about succession. At some stage, if we have kids, there's going to be issues that we're going to have to deal with the children. Let's make this, we're not going to just leave it. It's going to be on the table and it's going to be part of our strategic planning throughout that part of it. So that's, we'll put that to a side and get to the succession planning where you haven't done that or things have gone amok. And what do you do? So this is where I bring in my mediation training, and I've worked with financial advisors on this. They're saying, well, if we, the financial advisor says, well, if I get instructed, I get instructed by the head of the family or the heads of the family, right? And so the children or the extended family, whether they're grandchildren or nephews or nieces, they don't trust me to find out what they want. But for me to do great succession planning from a financial perspective, I really need to know what the needs of those children or grandchildren, extended family are. And they're not going to speak to me. That's when they bring me in as a mediator using mediator techniques because I'm an independent party. And they know I'm an independent party. And so I use those techniques to find out what do the people want and are there any disputes about to erupt. And so people speak to me on hand. They know that I can't tell, part of mediation, I can't tell anyone what they say unless they give me permission. So it gives them the freedom to say, if I'm speaking to, I had a case recently, case, a matter recently where we were dealing with three children. One's in the business, one was a doctor, one was a lawyer. And they all had different needs and wants. And because I said, you can tell me what you want and let's talk about the negotiation and find out what you need, they felt secure because it was a someone they could bat ideas off without actually with knowing that I wasn't going to tell on it. We could have that conversation. So part of that was saying, well, what do you want? Why do you want it? And how important is your family relationship to you? Because when mom and dad are gone, right, the three of you are going to be left. And are you okay with never speaking to each other again? So can this be a free for all? Or are we going to try and keep the family relationship going? Right. So in that particular case, it was difficult because one son was in the business. He was very invested in the business. He was spending time there that week. And he was taking over the reins and he had started taking a lead in that business. The others, yes, had played in the business when they were kids, but now they were, they had their own professions. They would get certain dividends from the business because they had some shares in it, but come to an occasional board meeting, but they weren't really involved or invested in the business except for an income distribution at some stage. So what do you do? The one child says, the lawyers says, I just want money. So if they can, the parents can decide, they can give me cash now, I'll live with it and pay out my share of that business, and then the brother who's in the business can do what he wants with it. I don't care, just give me the money up front now. The other brother who's a doctor, kind of, I don't know why, I think he had a child who he thought might be interested in going into the business. So he felt that he wanted that family connection and he didn't want to just get the cash. And the son who was working the business said, why should they get all this cash for the amount of money that I've spent all my time building up this business? So it was a matter of saying, well, okay, where's the family relationship in this? And also thinking what is fair and what isn't fair. Is it fair for one person to be working really hard in a business and, giving profits to parties who are not in the business and don't have much interest? On the other hand, is it fair that this person was in the business that was created by the parents? He walked into a good business with the parents helping him, meanwhile the other two were creating their own professional opportunities. So we sat together, worked out what they needed, but also worked out that they wanted to retain the relationship. And then said, now you've got to work out what you're going to say to your parents one-on-one and then with each other. And whatever you say, understand that that might not lead to the other parts. You don't know what's going to happen. And so that took a long time of preparation and thinking. We started with, it was the same concepts of negotiating with each other. I obviously couldn't take a position of who I thought was right or wrong, but it's like preparation, strategic planning. Are the other people involved? How do I persuade them? What can I give them to make them feel that they want to give me this? And so on. And so all the three had that basis. They had their prepared to persuade. They had their thoughts and their outcomes. And then we put them individually in the room with the parents to say what they thought. And then the parents asked for them to sit together. But that in that interim, when they were with the parents had worked out that they would give, they like the daughter's idea, give the wealth now, give them something now, and let's the children now, let's not wait till they die. Let's sort this all out now. And we'll have a separate agreement with the son in the business of how we're going to transfer our management and walk away from the business eventually.
Well,
That's a
that's often a
complex.
family saver, which is let's deal with it now as opposed to dealing with it, after we're not on the planet because we were being avoidant. I see that so often with family businesses where you have one person who's slogging their guts out in the business, possibly at a below market wage, a couple of other siblings who are off doing their own careers or having their own families, and the grass is always greener on the other side. So the person who's flogging themselves in the business is looking over the fence and saying, "Oh, geez, those peanuts, they're actually, they seem to only work a 40-hour week. They're getting $200,000 from a ASX top 100. How hard can that be? And here I am trying to save the family asset, blah, blah, blah." And all this, there's all that emotion that goes in it. And of course, you've also got the partners of each of the siblings as well, who also have their own perspectives, which they have every right to. And they may see the sacrifice that their partners, whose primary responsibility is making. So it's an activity that becomes very emotionally charged, particularly, when little Billy actually, punched me in the side, when I was six, and I'm still pissed off about the fact that he got away with it. He never actually said, "I'm sorry." And
And
so,
mum always loved him more than me.
And so all of this stuff comes to the fore, or my sister's blackmailing the parents about whether or not they'll see the grandchildren ever again, if she doesn't get the if she doesn't get the same pay as I do in the business, despite the fact that she only works there 3 hours a week, and I've seen exactly this situation in the past. So it's, I guess, it comes back to a couple of things. One is, if you're thinking about going into business with family, don't. If you are going to go into business with family, actually put together a decent shareholders agreement or a business agreement with an exit strategy and criteria set up front. That'd be a part two. Part three would be understand the difference between the three types of income that an organization actually pays. It's an employee, a shareholder, and its directors. So a market wage, directors' fees, and return on dividends for the shareholders. All that's great stuff. But if you get to the point where none of that's in place, which is exactly what you just described, then being able to understand each person's position and be able to help them come to the table in a rational way, trying to minimize the amount of emotion, understanding what they're happy to accept and what they're prepared to give up, and have that view as to, well, what do we want to be? What do we want to be doing in 20 years' time? Do I want to be sitting down for Christmas with my siblings and actually having an enjoyable time or any other festive occasion? Or are we still going to be niggling about the fact that, you got more than I did, or you pulled the money out of the business and I had to saddle it with debt for the rest of my life, etc. You know, those that long-term view is just so essential.
Oh, absolutely. I've seen it work well where families resolve this and continue, and I've seen it work terribly where the family don't speak to each other. You know, it's just crushed any family relationship.
Yeah, and that can be an absolute tragedy. But on the other hand, sometimes actually it might be best for them to actually go their separate ways and move on. So it's not simple. And
No.
every family is truly unique.
It is indeed. That's why negotiation is so fascinating, because I can give you those facts and different people in the room, even when I leave the room and leave them together, the personalities will take over and we don't know what's going to come out of it after that.
Absolutely.
Very
Well, this
exciting.
is a you have front row seat tickets to some of the best reality TV you can produce.
Exactly.
Oh dear. Well, I also see real issues when clients are going into business with someone. You know, all too often they avoid the tough questions, you know, market wages for effort, relative shareholdings, and so on, and what's the exit strategy? How do you help with that from a negotiation perspective? Because they're challenging conversations to have up front, because, you know, invariably when people decide to set up a business, there's lots of excitement and enthusiasm about the birth of this new business child that they're going to have together. And they can only see how beautifully matched they are from a skills being complementary or contrasting. And they've all got the same level of excitement about how they're going to, you know, really work to make this thing, you know, a unicorn. Because so unicorns are so
Happen every
prevalent.
day.
I'm surprised that they don't actually have, you know, pedestrian crossings specifically for unicorns. There's so many of them. So how do you see, you know, negotiation skills being deployed in that sort of scenario?
So again, I've had front row seats for this for so long based on my legal advice that I give to business, setting up business, especially in the entrepreneur and small business world, but also medium businesses. And the first part of it is, as you say, we get people really excited, might have had a coffee and decided, well, I've got a great idea, you've got a great idea, let's do it. And as you said, complementary skills. You're good at this, I'm good at that. What could go wrong?
What could go wrong?
And then you see someone like me, and look, if you were talking about family, you go see a lawyer before you get married, and we say, what happens if you die or get divorced? We really bring the tone down.
Yeah, you are a bit of a passion killer, of course, but it actually needs to be put onto a practical, logical, and well thought out basis, not just we're in love for the next 5 minutes.
Exactly. That's where we come in. So the first part of it is to say, I've got a great idea. I mean, negotiations and transactions, most of the time there's a great idea or there's a great opportunity. And this is the same thing. Going into business in a transaction, you're seeing an opportunity to do something, but it's not something of, I'm just going to buy, I don't know, I'm just going to buy a heater, or I'm just going to buy an air conditioner. This is, I'm going to buy a relationship to build a business. That's what I'm doing, if I think of it like that. But it's a long-term thing. So I've got to start right at the beginning saying, okay, let's get back to basics. And basics are preparation. What do I need? Long-term, where is that going? So not just, you know, really know what I need. What do I need to get from this for this to achieve my goals, whether it's short-term, long-term? Then is the person that I'm looking at the right person for the job? And I've got a terrible story that I can tell you after this, a breakdown of a relationship, but is this person the right person for what I need? And if they are, what do I need from them to achieve my goals? Right. And then how do we put it in place? As you talked about, the director's agreement, the shareholders' agreement, the market value for work, if there isn't sufficient funds in the business to actually pay a market salary, because when you're starting out, often that isn't the case. We have
No.
sweat equity happening. So these are all the thoughts that you need before you even sit down to have a serious conversation with the other person.
Yeah.
Once you know that, once you have your plan and what you needed, and then again, I would stress, in these business relationships, speak to a taxation expert, speak to a financial advisor or accountant. How does this work for you for your own personal needs, financial? And then again, speak to someone like you, John, who has, I'm busy, promote, but it's very important. Someone who's had experience in business who can give you some ideas because they've seen a lot about how to approach it. Once you've had that, then you're ready to sit down with the other person and have the conversation. And it's very important from the beginning, when you still love each other, to have the hard conversation, because once you're hating, it's almost impossible to have a decent, logical conversation. But when you love each other, it's easy to say, we know we're never going to break up, but if we do, what
How are
will
we
it
going to
look
do
like?
this? Yes.
When we have a fight about the distribution of dividends, how's it going to work? What happens if someone is working longer hours in the business? How do they get compensated for that, especially in the beginning where there might not be the funds to pay that person appropriately? And so we had these really serious conversations up front. I mean, in one case, I had someone, it's quite embarrassing, they were all so excited. I had six people in my office. They were like, we are going in. And I said, well, I'm looking at all of you. Who's actually going to run the business? There was deathly silence. They were the right fit. They just hadn't looked, who's going to run it? Like, who's going to, are we all diving in? Who's running it? And are we happy with that person? They hadn't thought of that because they had just seen the synergies of what they could bring, but not the day-to-day operation. So it's so important to take that time out, make sure you've worked that out, negotiate where it's happening, but do it with expertise. And you might think it's taking too long. And you might think I'm spending up too much money on John when, you know, hey, I kind of know. I looked at AI, I spoke to I spoke to ChatGPT,
Yeah, my
I put
favorite
it through
lawyer.
the mist, you know, and ChatGPT says this is what I need to know, right? That is you're preparing yourself to fail. And I'm not going to go off at ChatGPT. If you know a lot, ChatGPT is helpful. If you don't, you don't know what whether ChatGPT is being useful or not. But having the right people to guide you and give you advice and let you have that rant about what you're looking for and then bring you back to logic and to thinking and having those plans and then being able to sit together and have the discussion. And I can tell you, if you cannot, when you're still in love, when you're still building the relationship, have those hard conversations, you shouldn't be going into business together.
So totally in agreement with you. If you are avoiding those conversations at that point, when all the things that make the conversations easy, then when it gets hard, you're going to be in diabolical problems.
Yeah. And that's what actually happened. Take it to the bad case scenario. So in the one case, well, there's a number of cases where I've worked with clients day to day. One of them has hit the six-year anniversary since our first discussion. So I'm very excited and the business is growing and they put in place their dispute resolution, how to deal with it, and they've instituted at least twice. And it's worked. So we've had that. But the other has been terrible where the parties got together. One person thought they would be the face and the brand and work hard to build the business. The other was meant to be the backroom person. The backroom person could not be trusted. They didn't have a proper shareholder agreement in place. They had no business operations agreement in place. And one party literally walked away with nothing and the business collapsed after a number of years because there was nowhere to go.
Yeah, an absolute tragedy. And sometimes it's better to walk than it is to actually just stay in there in a toxic environment.
Yeah.
Are you looking to pinpoint the areas that will make the biggest impact on your business? Check out the Organization Performance and Value Diagnostic. This powerful tool lets you evaluate your business on multiple facets and provides email reminders to keep you on track. Head over to criticalfewactions.com.au. And get started now.
So, Elise, how is the confidentially speaking way of negotiation different from the standard, what I would describe as legalistic or aggressive styles of negotiation, where you come up with your BATNA and you just bat?
Are you quoting getting to yes there, John? The BATNAs and the WATNAs. I hate the word
Exactly.
BATNA. They always say it's a best alternative to negotiated agreement. What they mean is the best alternative is going to court and getting everything normally when lawyers talk about it. So starting off, there is the formula And I'm not saying I don't prefer in coaching or when I'm doing my own preparation for negotiation to ideas that come out of getting to yes and also never split the difference and all these stuff, these what are called the manuals on negotiation. But the difference between confidentially speaking and which is specifically a negotiation business of coaching and assisting parties negotiate is the commerciality, firstly, and flexibility. So we say you can use a formula, but if everybody uses a formula, then you're going to reach a deadline, right? But I wash my back, no, it's your back, now let's work together, right? Or it's really being flexible. So it's teaching parties to understand the negotiation, preparing them, the preparing to persuade in a commercial manner, being ready to have the conversations, long-term strategies, but it's all flexible to you. At the center of our negotiation training is yourself. I sound like a salesperson, but it's you. You are the center. It's about your abilities, about you taking things on and learning how to work with you to get the best out of it. And that includes being flexible. It includes knowing that one day, if you negotiate with me today, I might be a walkover because I haven't had that much sleep. But tomorrow, I might be ready. I've had a bad day. I've had an argument with someone. I'm going to be impossible to deal with. You need to be flexible. You need to be able to deal with your own emotions as to knowing who you are when you're walking in that room and what is going to stop you from getting the best out of that deal. But also to understand that you might be negotiating with the same people 100 times. But on any given day, they might change or their needs might change. So it's not a formula, and how am I flexible? So from formula to flexibility.
Look, I think you're absolutely right there. So just thinking about some of my mid-market clients, they deal with suppliers, banks, and big customers on a day-to-day basis. And those participants have got way more leverage and way more power in the relationship. I mean, if you go off to the CBA or the NAB bank and you say, well, look, I want to borrow my $2 million and I actually only want to pay 3% below the market indicator rate, there's not a lot of wriggle room there. But we've got to deal with banks and suppliers and large customers all the time. And what I see these business leaders do is really they take what they feel that they can get. What strategies could they use to actually level the playing field, when we think about that? Because
Well,
it does seem somewhat lopsided. It's either take it or leave it.
and often it is, right? I mean, if I want to get my Apple, or let's be fair, a Samsung phone, I can't go into Apple and say, well, I want special terms and conditions and I'm only paying $200 because I think I've looked at the market value and that's what it's worth. Right. There's some places where it's a standard form agreement, and I'll work up how that works in the negotiation. So the first thing is to understand sometimes you will not be able to negotiate. It just isn't. But there's certain times of year, or there's certain times in a financial season where people might be trying to get their budgets right. So if it's not a standard form agreement, if I'm not just one on a treadmill, you sign up to this and you can sell your products. And I'm being mean to Coles, so I'll mention Woolworths as well. They're very difficult to negotiate with. You want your stuff on the shelves. This is what it is, and this is what you have to do. And what are you going to do? Everybody signs up to that if you want to be in Coles and Woolworths. But there are things, for example, in banks, if they're trying to get a number of loans across in a certain time, if they haven't met certain requirements, I think there might be some times when you need to look at when are they more vulnerable. Is it before their reporting season? Isn't it? Do I have a business manager I can speak to there, who I can have a discussion about percentages? Do am I that person who can walk in because I have sufficient funds, where I might not be the billionaire, but I am the person who they might want investing because they need my money. Or they need my loan. So you might be able to get a slightly better deal based on cycle, based on the need, and that requires a lot of research. And whether that's worth it or not to you is another story. But there are times when that is possible, and looking at the cycle of how the banks might need more loans in the book than other times, and that might be the time to go in and have a look.
Yeah, well, absolutely. The best time to buy a car is in the last 2 days of the month when they're trying to hit their numbers.
Exactly. And I would say the best time is end of January or the beginning of February, or the end of January, end of February, because if you're prepared to buy a car from the last season, they're trying to get rid of stock. Last year, they're trying to get rid of stock. That's my personal experience.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there, it could be a season of that. Then when it comes to the bigger customers and we're talking about supply, if there are no standard form agreements again, the thing is to also look professional. I see so many businesses who are desperate to get into the big suppliers chain or to supply to the bigger end of the market. For example, saying I'll have a discussion with you without a confidentiality agreement, because if I have that, if I start making moves, they'll move away from me. Actually, the opposite. If they see that you run a tight ship, you are more reliable as a supplier.
Yeah.
So if they see that you run a good business, that you worry about cash flow, that you're looking at various things, well, that means that hopefully you'll be able to continue supplying their needs as it happens. If you're that person who just says, give me a serviette and I'll just agree a number that you throw at me, the risk to the bigger business is that your business won't survive, and it cannot survive if you don't get paid in a certain time, if you're not reliable, if you don't have things in writing. So that's an important thing. Look professional. Always walk in and say, I've got a lot to, you know, I do have something. I might not be the biggest supplier in the market, but I provide an option for your client or customers that they don't have. Or, you know, I can get you into a market that you're not in. You're in the big end of town. So believe in yourself. Know that you're not going to get the best deal, most probably, but come in professionally. Then we get to the standard form agreement. That's where you don't have much of a say. Now, in terms of the Competition and Consumer Act, there are things called unfair terms, and small business are covered by it, maybe not medium business so much so. But if there are terms that are forced on you and they are unfair, you can actually take that to court and you can threaten it in the negotiation. Say, if this is unfair, and I think it is, and this is why I think it's unfair, this can be thrown out.
Well, you often see that in the construction industry.
Yeah. And you're going to lose all your rights because you're going to be unfair to me. You're going to lose all your rights. So one of the things I do when I'm dealing with a big client, because if I'm dealing on behalf of an entrepreneur, small, medium client, and there's a huge company we're dealing with on the other side, I always say to them, is this a standard form of agreement or not? If they say it's a standard form of agreement, I say, fine, well, this is unfair, this is unfair, this is unfair. I'm looking forward to challenging this with the ACCC. And I'm, you know, and throw words like it's anti-competitive if you need to. And it's amazing how many times they capitulate, because they also, if you're a big company, you don't want the high risk of a huge case or the ACCC taking you, your brand value is lost.
The brand damage for them is often a bigger issue than anything else.
Yeah. So you have to decide. Or you might say, as a standard form of agreement, I know I can challenge the unfairness and I just need to put something in my processes to make sure I don't get caught with.
Yeah. But also I've sort of seen, and particularly in the mining sector, I've had clients that serve the mining industry. And when we first start talking, they talk about, well, you know, I provide this capital equipment to the mining company, and they tell me that I'm going to get paid in 90 days. I've got to wear all the risk up front. And that's the way we've been doing it for the last 5 years. And that's just the way they are. And it never changes. And you know, I say to them, well, have you actually had this conversation with them? And it's not always the case, but it's been surprising how often it has been the case that, you know, they've actually sat down with the purchasing officer and they've talked about cash flow being an essential part of how they can actually help deliver the services and the products to the client. And, you know, they've been able to get their 30, 40, 50% upfront on purchase order. They've been able to get payments on the first time that they've actually started building the equipment. And there's always been some retention, which is appropriate, and that's an adequate thing, but it's completely transformed their cash flow simply because they were prepared. And then they actually did have the conversation, which they just assumed was not even an option available to them. You know, I'm a great believer in she who asks the best questions leads. And I encourage all my mentees to learn that by heart and to ask open questions and STFU, you know, embrace the silence. But so often people think that that's actually, you know, something that they can't even start with.
They see it almost like a monarchy, you know, where you couldn't go and speak to the king because you'd get you'd get the guillotine or whatever it was. Your head would be chopped off because you dared look at a king. But the reality is it's a business. And what I know, having worked both sides of that, they'll always take, you know, with cash flow, those people who prepare not to fight for being paid exactly 30 days, they'll love to hold the cash flow off as long as possible, their cash for their cash flow purposes. So if you're not fighting for it, they're not going to fight for you. But if you do, you know, if you phone them up and say, as you say, have that conversation and don't be scared of it. And also be ready to ask yourself the question, if I get paid in 90 days and if I can't afford to stay in business, then how is that helpful?
Yeah.
You know, and make that conversation. Don't be scared of it. If you've got a product that they want, clearly. I mean, there's also a problem is this my last lead? I'm going to lose a bit of money and it's going to take me a while to get paid. But because my product is being used by this company, it is a brand value for me to sell to other companies.
Yeah. And of course, you know, the situation becomes different if you're in a heavily commoditized market where you're all vigorously playing that race to the bottom, in which case, frankly, you actually have only got a business on a temporary basis, which is quite sad, but that's the reality. So, Elise, what are the gotchas, the things that can really go wrong in the negotiation process?
Well, the first is to lose sight of where you're going, right? So let's not. First, but it's one of the things that I put first and foremost on my thought process is when you get another person in the room and you're part of this discussion, especially if the negotiation is taking place in person as opposed to through writing, because some negotiations people never meet, it's all done in writing. But if it's in person, you get caught up in the discussion, the person's very charming, you're having a lot of fun, they're playing with ideas. And look, I'm a person who can get caught up in that as well. Great fun. We're having a wonderful time. What a great idea. That's a wonderful idea. I haven't actually thought of where it sits with me, but wow, I never thought of that before. I'm going down that rabbit hole. And so it's losing sight of where you're going and getting caught up in the process and forgetting the purpose.
Yeah.
So keep a steady head. And when you find yourself getting excited about something, take a break and go back to basics. Go back to basics. Okay, that's a great idea. Does it fit within me? Is it worth me continuing this discussion on this? Or is it going to take me down a rabbit hole and I'm going to lose where I'm going? So keep sturdy. The other is emotions. Emotions. And I can be emotional. So this, you know, I've had to learn really, really good techniques of how to hold in the emotion when I'm, you know, getting so excited about something or really angry. And people can make you, you know, if you're dealing with a combat artist in the law, they can make you really, really angry. And you're just ready to shout and scream and you can throw something completely out of the window because you let your emotions get the better of you. So check your emotions, make sure, and always have someone who you can battle, if not in the room with you, but someone you can say, okay, I need to take a break, phone a friend, and have that conversation, bring you down and ready to go in. Don't be scared to stop the conversation if you feel that you're getting out of control or your emotions are getting the better of you. It's better to stop then, take a break, whatever is needed. The other is to believe that you need a result at all costs and that you've got to keep going that day for a result. If you don't, something's going to end and it's going to be terrible. Just sometimes all costs mean giving up completely on what you're trying to achieve. So make sure that that's not important. If I'm going into negotiation, I don't need a result at all costs unless it practically means that I'm getting my head chopped off by the king. Other than that, keep your head about you don't need to resolve today and you don't need to resolve at all costs.
Yeah, great insights. That's really interesting. I can see how this applies across absolutely any business, any industry, because it actually applies to any business situation. Yeah.
If you really want to kick off your strategic planning and work in a supportive environment with other CEOs and leaders, the CEO Masterclass in Strategic Planning and Implementation is for you. This 10-month small group course helps you craft your strategic plan, present it to a group of peer investors, and develop a habit of monthly implementation. Our waitlist is open now at criticalfewactions.com.au.
So, Elise, thinking broadly about mid-market businesses, if a founder or a CEO is looking to really improve their negotiation outcomes, what critical few actions should they start tomorrow if they did nothing else?
Besides coming to my masterclass, sorry, John.
of course.
Basically, the first is to look at the way they prepare.
Yeah.
And look at how they strategically think about negotiations. And so it's actually introspection. The first step is introspection. Mm. What worked, what doesn't work. You know, many founders and CEOs might say, but I do what it is. I'm always prepared. Mm. I do that. Well, think of how you prepare and think of has that worked and what hasn't worked previously. Do an inventory. Strategically thinking, think around getting the right people around you when you are preparing or thinking around negotiations. Mm. Get advice from other people who might be able to influence your outcome.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe we should send you into the negotiation and not me. I mean, I had one great negotiator. He's one of the best negotiators in the business. Every time we put him in front of government, he crashed. Because he understood the business minds. He understood the people he was talking to in business. Government, a whole new thing. So he's not allowed near any government. Crashed and burned with government. So, you know, maybe get the right people in certain places. Maybe you are brilliant in certain areas, you're not in others. Be prepared to accept that and do a deep dive. And the other is to make sure that whatever's negotiated, this is the lawyer in me, is well documented so that there's no argument after.
Yeah, because memory doesn't work. And if it's not written down, it never happened.
Exactly. And we all have different memories of what we thought. Even if we think we have the greatest memory, the other person's memory might be working at a different level.
Yeah, absolutely. Elise, we've really covered a lot of ground today, and it's been absolutely fascinating. Are there any resources, books, or videos that you feel might be helpful as founders and leaders look to develop their skills?
Videos, you can always go onto our website or YouTube clips. I think everybody talks about getting to yes. Everybody talks about don't split the difference. Read both of them. Don't read one, not the other, because they actually have a little bit of fight about what the best thing to do is. I would always start with those two just because they are the foundational books on negotiation that everybody talks about.
Yeah.
Once you've got the foundations, then you can look further afield if you find that interesting. But practice is the best source, and speaking to others about what their experience was and speaking to people, you know, who are always in that field.
And not necessarily spend all your time scrolling reels from the FBI negotiator on Instagram.
Exactly. I love him. It's fun to watch. But at the end of the day, you are the person who's going to make that difference. And if you're so busy watching others do and reading the formulas, you might get lost in where you're heading.
Yeah. Well, practice certainly makes for a skill improvement as opposed to just watching somebody else do it. Otherwise, I'd probably be a world-class tennis player.
Well, there you go. Wimbledon next year, Jeff.
There you go. Elise, it's been an absolute delight to talk with you about negotiation today. I've really enjoyed it immensely, and I've learned a lot, which I'll be looking to apply immediately. Thank you so much for your insights.
It's a pleasure, John. Lovely speaking today.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Critical Few Actions podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and grab the downloadables from the show notes. And if you found this episode helpful, I'd really appreciate it if you share it with your peers and your team. Stay focused and take action. The Critical Few Actions podcast, including show notes and links, provides general information only and is not individualized business advice, nor can it be relied upon as such. you must take responsibility for your own advice, decisions, and actions.